Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. When we think of American exceptionalism, a few ideas might come to mind. The colonists taking over Indian land as their God-given right, manifest destiny. The initial description of the concept can be traced to French sociologist and political theorist Alexis de Tocqueville, who traveled to the United States in 1831 to study its prisons and uncovered a wealth of broader observations, namely that America is an exceptional country in that it's an exception, a singular nation, but not necessarily a superior one. Coincidentally, Masha Gessen in our earlier segment talked about a state of exception as an attack, or after an attack, as an excuse for autocracy, coined by somebody in Hitler's time and in that context. But in the context of de Tocqueville, joining me now is another Frenchman with his take on American exceptionalism, 21st century style, and how it might be driving Americans apart today. Mugambi Jue is a professor at Stanford Law School, former human rights lawyer here in Manhattan, and author of a new book called Exceptional America: What Divides Americans from the World and from Each Other. Welcome to the show and the Green Space, Professor Jue.
Thank you so much.
First, about you, to let people get to know you a little bit. You have an interesting multinational background. How is it that you came to practice and teach law in the United States?
Well, unlike Barack Obama, I was actually born in Kenya. My father is Kenyan, my mother is French, and after being born in Nairobi, I grew up in Paris in a multicultural environment. And ultimately, I decided to move to the U.S. for college, going from Paris, France, not to Paris, Texas, but to Houston, Texas, and ultimately stayed on and became a human rights lawyer here. And I was really fascinated not only about the contrasts between America as a whole and France or other Western democracies living here, but at the huge contrast within the United States. I spent about 6 years in New York, spent time in New England, Chicago, in Alabama, Georgia, California. And this is a big part of polarization, that America is very divided at a regional level, but it's also very divided at a partisan level because Americans routinely clash over a broad range of issues that are not controversial elsewhere in the West, like whether people should have a basic right to health care, whether special interests should be allowed to spend unlimited money on political elections and on lobbying, whether climate change is a hoax invented by know-it-all scientists or a scientific reality, whether women should have a basic right to abortion, whether contraception should be covered by people's health insurance, whether people should have an unbridled right to bear arms, whether to have mass incarceration, the death penalty, and whether even it's appropriate to reintroduce torture into Western civilization.
That's a list. And those things that make us exceptional in political terms, compared primarily to other Western democracies, I guess, are there things in U.S. history that you have come to understand laid the groundwork for that as a related set of exceptions?
Yes, a lot of this stems from American exceptionalism in the original sense of the phrase, namely that America is an exception. And most people today think that American exceptionalism means a faith in American superiority, exceptional in the sense of outstanding or phenomenal. But historically, it's primarily meant that America is an exception objectively and descriptively, especially compared to other Western democracies, that is, European countries, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And a broad range of issues in terms of America's history, culture, law, politics, race relations, economic attitudes, religious beliefs have shaped all of these divides.
Who coined the term?
So, interestingly, the phrase American exceptionalism was not coined by Tocqueville himself, as far as we know. Instead, it has been ironically traced to American communists. We used it in the early 20th century to talk about how the so-called universal laws of Marxism would have to evolve differently in America because of its distinct set of social and economic conditions. And after that epoch, it was mainly used by American academics who analyzed how America is different from other countries and for which reasons. And eventually, the phrase became widely used for the first time during the Obama presidency. And that's because Republican politicians routinely accused Obama of betraying American exceptionalism and the heritage of the founding fathers. But it's not what the phrase historically meant.
You outline in the book four ways in which the polarization in this country has made it an exception in the Western world. That's not just the list of particular issues that we went through before, right?
So there are four factors that are interrelated that shape much of American polarization: profound anti-intellectualism in parts of the country, fervent Christian fundamentalism, a visceral suspicion of government, and racial resentment. And put together, these four factors create a very hardline anti-rational ideology that is very hostile to compromise. And these factors were already there well before Donald Trump even thought about becoming president, because they are rooted in unique dimensions of American history and culture.
How did we get to anti-intellectualism in this country? Because one reading of American history would be that the founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin, who made discoveries in electricity and meteorology, the intellectual power that went into the Federalist Papers, you know, and whether you were more on Hamilton's side or Jefferson's side or Burr's side, of some of the arguments that people who saw the play Hamilton or reminded, you know, really took place about the nature of society. How did we get from the founding of the country based on those things to the pervasive anti-intellectualism that you rightly cite?
Ironically, this stems from a positive dimension of American exceptionalism, namely the fact that America was the first Western democracy to emerge from the Enlightenment. So the American Revolution of 1776 preceded the French Revolution of 1789, and with the birth of American democracy came an egalitarian spirit. Now, of course, it was full of contradictions, ranging from the cruelties of African slavery to the persecution of Native Americans, or the disenfranchisement of women in a firmly patriarchal society, but it was an egalitarian sentiment nonetheless. And as the historian Richard Hofstadter explained, this egalitarian sentiment created a populist conception not only of democracy in parts of the country, but of education, where some people started equating education with elitism, education as a badge of the pseudo-aristocracy, and that fostered the notion that people really don't need to be too educated because common sense is just good enough to understand the world and to make money. And this is the roots of the anti-intellectual mindset of not only Donald Trump, but many other American politicians, from Sarah Palin to George W. Bush, which seems increasingly rational as each day goes by.
Listeners, anybody want to call in and talk about American exceptionalism or anything related with Mugambi Jouwe, professor at Stanford Law School, former human rights lawyer here in Manhattan, and now the author of the book, Exceptional America, What Divides Americans from the World and from Each Other? And for our audience members here in the green space, you can raise your hand and we can come around and you can ask them a question if you like. You mentioned in the context of your last answer a positive aspect of American exceptionalism that wound up leading to anti-intellectualism. I think your original framing of American exceptionalism was more along negative lines. Are there other positive aspects to it that you would cite?
Yes, there are many positive dimensions of American exceptionalism and others that also contribute to significant polarization. So one major aspect of American society is that is the Western democracy with by far the highest proportion of Christian fundamentalists. According to data, between a third and 40% of Americans are creationists, would think that God created human beings in their present form and that the theory of evolution is false. And a similar proportion believe in apocalyptic biblical prophecies about the imminent second coming of Christ and the rapture. But these forms of radical Christian theology partly stem from positive dimensions of American exceptionalism, including the fact that Americans have not experienced as long a history of religious conflict and clerical domination as some Europeans did in the past, and therefore many Americans start to see religions not as social institutions, not as means of social power, but as mere means of worship. And that made them less skeptical of radical conceptions of Christianity, which play a big role today because the religious right is a major political movement that also embraced Donald Trump's rhetoric.
Is it ironic to you that with the United States being, as you said, the first country that was formed on the principles of the Enlightenment, that it would be as religious as it is, as opposed to more rejecting of religion?
It's a great paradox in a sense that several founding fathers, including some of the most influential ones, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Paine, were skeptical of Christian dogma. And among those who held Christian beliefs, many of them were far more moderate than Christian fundamentalists of today in how they thought about religion, such as John Adams, who was a Unitarian. So it's a great paradox and historical reversal.
Let's take a question here in the green space. Who's got it? Hi.
Hi. So my question is about whether you think kind of weak educational systems are leading to some of this resentment of the intellectual classes, and that the divide between the professional classes and the rest of the U.S. is really what we need to address.
The fundamental issue with anti-intellectualism is not really poor quality of education. In many ways, American education is quite good by international standards. So K-12 has struggled as of late, but it's not at the very bottom in the modern Western world. And American universities are often regarded as the very best in the entire world. But anti-intellectualism is more about a peculiar conception of education that can even be shared by graduates of top universities, because it's a skepticism of education that does not seem to have a practical purpose, such as an example I provide in my book of a classmate who said, well, I don't see the point about learning about history. What is that going to help me in my career? And this type of mindset among people who can be very studious, who can be very intelligent, of course, has a broader political impact, because it makes people receptive to propaganda by politicians, say about, well, other Western democracies live under the tyranny of socialized medicine, or the more guns that people have, the safer society is. And a lot of people who graduate from universities today are not able to make sense of very simple facts.
We even had the example a couple of years ago, were you aware of this, where the governor of Florida floated the idea of charging more tuition to students in the state university who are studying anthropology. He mentioned anthropology and other things like that. I guess it would have included other social sciences, because there wasn't a relationship between those studies and contribution to the economy.
Yes, and there are many other examples I provide in my book. For example, Ronald Reagan, when he was governor of California, complained that the state's great universities were subsidizing intellectual curiosity, and professors retorted that this was their very mission.
We will continue in a minute with Mugambi Jue, whose very mission, I presume, at the Stanford Law School is what we just heard. And he's the author of the new book, Exceptional America, What Divides Americans from the World and from Each Other. Among other things, we'll hear what de Tocqueville observed about the criminal justice system in the United States in the early 1800s that relates to mass incarceration today. Stay with us.
The city of Boston designing a plan to tackle complicated issues of race.
Because when you think about what's happened in the country, whether it's been the acts of in Ferguson or New York, or what's happened in Fenway Park and racist remarks all over the place, we need to do better as a society.
Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, that's next time on The Takeaway, weekday afternoons at 3 on 93.9 FM.
WNYC receives support from Audible, offering a selection of audiobooks across a variety of genres, including memoirs, mysteries, motivational books, and more, via the Audible app on smartphones or tablets. Learn more at audible.com/listen. LV Wood, manufacturers of bespoke wood flooring. Bespoke wood floors are made to order and are all made in the USA. The New York showroom at 24 West 20th Street is open to the public. More at lvwood.com. WNYC is a media partner for the 39th season of the Brick Celebrate Brooklyn Festival, open to all. Thursday, an experimental indie rock night with Yesayer, Polisa, and Cymbals Eat Guitar, 7 p.m. at Prospect Park Bandshell, brickartsmedia.org.
If you believe democracy requires a free press, your station is WNYC, 93.9 FM and AM 820, NPR News and the New York Conversation.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live from the Green Space with Stanford University Law Professor Mugambi Jouye, whose new book is Exceptional America, What Divides Americans from the World and from Each Other. And let's take a caller. Here is Anne in Brooklyn. Anne, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you for this excellent show today. I had a question regarding evangelicals who voted for Trump. How do they square with themselves in terms of voting for a man who represents pretty much every one of the seven deadly sins? Is it just East Coast hatred for East Coast liberals? Is it the hatred for education? Or was it just simply the sexism, against Hillary Clinton, that they would vote for a person who pretty much, he exemplifies so much of what they're supposedly against? So that's my question.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You do know the answer, right?
It does seem a paradox because, after all, Donald Trump does not seem particularly religious, even though he says that the Bible is his favorite book, alongside The Art of the Deal. But the answer stems from not only the fact that Christian fundamentalists identify with other parts of his agenda, such as repealing Obamacare, but also that Christian fundamentalism is an ideology that extends beyond theological questions like the theory of evolution or culture war matters like abortion and gay rights to other areas because it shapes black and white, anti-rational, anti-intellectual, authoritarian mindsets. And these are also among the traits of Donald Trump, which helps explain why they are drawn to this type of leader.
You write very interestingly about how de Tocqueville in the 1830s thoroughly studied American prisons. I think people associate de Tocqueville more with studying civil society and things like that. But he also looked at our prisons, and he wrote that in no country is criminal justice administered with more mildness than in the United States. And, our listeners know, a lot of them do, that we have 5% of the global population, but 25% of the global prison population. So what was the criminal justice system like when Tocqueville was experiencing it? And is there a relationship between that and what we call mass incarceration today?
It's a great paradox that, indeed, in Tocqueville's epic in the 19th century, America was advanced in many ways. Tocqueville wrote a book where he argued that France should adopt some of America's penal practices, and today it's the exact opposite. Experts regard America as a great example of things not to do when it comes to criminal justice. And it's also interesting, if we look at the death penalty today, America is the only Western democracy to still have the death penalty, and is usually in the top five countries worldwide, alongside authoritarian regimes and dictatorships in the number of people it executes. But some American states like Michigan and Wisconsin abolished death penalty permanently in the 19th century, well before Western European nations. And that not only reflects the contrasts of American society, but also how mass incarceration is so peculiar. And it speaks really to the deterioration of the American social contract, because it's really important to understand that America has mass incarceration, not only on a scale unprecedented in American history, but practically unprecedented in the history of humankind. And one can really judge how much a society values human rights, human dignity, and equality, not by how it treats the most privileged members of society, but by how it treats the least privileged and even the worst of the worst.
Linda in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Linda. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning, Brian and Professor Jouye. Oh, by the way, Professor Jouye, just to go back for a second, you were talking about the universities and this thing about anthropology and one should have to pay more for such things. Perhaps you've read Robert Maynard Hutchins. He was the youngest dean of the Yale Law School, I think at 25 in the 30s. He later became the president of the University of Chicago and wanted to keep American universities from being contaminated by what he called vocational training. He lost out, obviously. That's what we have now, it seems to me, by and large. Anyway, I wanted to ask your view. Samuel Huntington, in one sentence, said what's basically my view. The West, i.e. the United States in this case, won the world not by the superiority of its ideas or values or religion, but rather by its superiority in applying organized violence. Westerners often forget this fact, non-Westerners never do. And I wonder, do you think, it seems to me that this policy in the greater world has been turned inward on the people of the United States themselves, especially black people, that organized violence, including emotional and intellectual violence. And I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we see a parallel not only between the war on crime, but also the war on terror and how people think about these issues in very black and white terms. They'll demonize offenders in America, in good part because of race prejudice and class discrimination as well against poor whites. And in terms of how they think about terrorism, there's a notion that it's not something that can be explained by social or political reasons, but it's something simply shaped by how some human beings are evil. And this mindset is rooted in different dimensions of American society, and also it shapes U.S. foreign policy a lot. We see that America is the Western democracy that exempts itself from international human rights treaties the most often. Also, it's the most likely to use force, and that was exemplified by the invasion of Iraq, which proved extremely controversial. And to this day, as I provide evidence in the book, a substantial proportion of Americans, 40 to 50%, still think that invading Iraq was the right decision.
Let's go to Zeban on Staten Island. You're on WNYC with Professor Jouet. Hello, Zeban. Zeban, you there?
Yes, good morning. How are you doing?
Doing all right. Go ahead.
Okay, The caller before this one wanted to make a comparison between white evangelical Christians, their notion of Christianity, and voting for Mr. Trump. Well, my mother likes to compare African politicians to Republican politicians. She says they both crave power, but they have no idea as to how to govern. All they want is raw power. It doesn't matter how they get the power. So she calls them white evangelical hypocrites. I just wanted to put that in and see if our guests can react to it.
Well, that's a pretty big generalization about African politicians,
yes,
and Republicans, for that matter.
That's what my mother says.
Yes.
So, the history...
And rule number one is listen to your mother, right?
The history of American religion and Protestantism is complex, and the evangelical movement is actually not uniform. I provide examples in a book of figures like Reverend Sizek, who supports same-sex marriage and equality and other progressive causes, and therefore it would be incorrect to paint everyone with the same brush. But still, if we look at some of their hardline positions, they not only stand out within American society, but also very much so by international standards.
We just have under a minute left. What do you hope people take away from this book?
It's really important to understand the root causes of why America became so polarized. And also, if America is to move forward, there are different things that people can do, not only be well-versed in different fields, learn about American history, but also not have an insular mindset, learn about the experiences of other countries. But in the end, Americans have made so many great contributions to democracy and to social progress that it's not only important to turn to other countries, but to turn inward if America is to move forward. And where there's life, there's hope.
Stanford Law Professor Mugambi Jouet, his new book is Exceptional America, What Divides Americans from the World and from Each Other. Thank you so much for coming to the Green Space today.